Are you ready?
Welcome to First Amendment Friday on the Lars Larson Show.
Friday is for everybody.
Today, Lars puts you in the driver's seat. You talk about what you want to talk about.
Government is the problem.
No topic is off limits.
It looks like the Canadians are here.
Call 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS.
Thank goodness it's Friday. Happy Friday. Friday.
This is
First Amendment Friday with Lars Larson.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. The current management of Northwest Forest, whether they're owned by the federal government or state governments, is being mismanaged to an incredible degree. If you don't believe me, wait for the smoke later on this summer, because on an average year in Oregon, we'll see 500,000 acres burn. Washington State, about 500,000. Last year in Oregon, it was almost 2 million acres of trees that went up in smoke. And yet, we could solve the problem and make money and provide jobs and have taxes paid to state governments in both Oregon and Washington and the federal government as well. Well, when I saw that there's a series out about timber issues in Skamania County, Washington, I thought I got to reach out to Rick Dancer. Hey, Rick, welcome to the program.
Hey, Lars, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Well, you and I have known each other a long time. What is this series about and what does it propose?
So 3 years ago, we started this series, and it was after the Labor Day fires when my wife and I lived up the McKenzie River. And, you know, I always had agreed with you in terms of we are not managing. There's not even mismanaging. They're not even managing our forests. And, you know, all the spotted owl habitat that they protected along the McKenzie River is exactly what burned. So the very plan that they came up with to protect the owl is what caused the devastation and destruction of its habitat. So I proposed to some folks in the timber industry who I knew really well. We came up with a series. They sponsor it. It's Healthy Forest, Healthy Communities, Starfire Lumber, and American Forest Resources Council sponsor the show for me. And then I go out and shoot stuff in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Montana, where I live now. And we cover stories that people don't know, that people, you know, for instance, with the most recent is Skamania County. And those people are getting just, can I say screwed?
Yes. Yes, you can say screwed. Okay. The SEC is okay with that.
Okay, they're getting screwed because, you know, you've got, what do? They have no farmland. They have mountainous land with thousands and thousands of acres of timber ready to be harvested. Part of it they can't harvest because it's in the Mount St. Helens National Monument. Some of it's in the Columbia River Gorge. So they got in this beautiful area where everything's restricted now, and then you have the you know, spotted owl plan. And by the way, I think one of the people told me they don't even have a spotted owl in that area. But
I'm willing to bet they don't, because you've heard probably that they're going to have to go out and slaughter the barred owl because the barred owls keep eating the spot. I'm not kidding. They're going to spend millions of dollars.
Isn't that the craziest? Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like the spotted owl was not made ready for prime time. You know, God apparently thought this is a pretty pathetic owl. It gets eaten by, you know, by other owls. And oh, by the way, it needs a special kind of timber, unless, of course, you find the one living in the Kmart sign, because either way, they seem to do okay until the barred owl comes along and eats them.
Well, see, in Skamania County, what's happening is, you know, like any place. I mean, this is the story of rural Washington, Oregon, Idaho, Montana. Is, you know, they're supposed to get money when the Forest Service was set up to manage forests, and those forests would then give back revenue to the counties and the schools to run them, to operate them.
Yep.
And for decades, Skamania County was like the, you know, cream of the crop. They have a joke that they had to buy new trucks to put the money in so they could, you know, take it to the county to run the county, you know, and now they're squalling. I mean, their schools, they're losing students, you know, and that's $10,000 a student that leaves because they don't have the programs that they used to. They don't have any maintenance. And Lars, here's the stuff that really just burns me is, so, you know, the small amount of timber that is cut there, the money goes to the state of Washington, and then they reallocate it to other districts. And guess who gets it? Not Skamania County, where they can't, you know, put in a Nordstrom's, or they don't have a Boeing or anything like that. They have timber. So the timber cut on their land in their county is then sent to the state. It's then distributed to more urban areas, and they build brand new schools. And here these people are sucking water. You know?
Yeah, and it doesn't make any sense because, Rick, I know they have this thing called PILT, payment in lieu of taxes, but that doesn't solve the problem because it may fund the government. So, in other words, one government is funding another government, and you say, well, what about all the things in the community that would have been paid for by all the timber jobs? Cutting trees, hauling trees, milling trees, making the lumber, selling the lumber, all those jobs. And you say, what about those? Oh, no. The county's perfectly happy. The county is still getting its money. The rest of you people are, as you said, screwed.
Right. Well, then Ron Wyden, you know, that comes up with the rural schools safety program, you know. But like this year, they aren't even sure they're going to get it. And you have to sit around, and it's like $1 million. And for them, that's a lot of money. And so if that doesn't come in, then they have to, they were, the day I was there shooting the interviews with these folks, the school district, the night before they'd had a meeting and they were laying off, I think, 9 to 10 staff. And in a small district like that, that's a huge deal. They're having to shut down schools and join middle schools and little schools, you know, putting everybody together because they don't have the money or the kids to operate the rest of them.
Hey, by the way, I don't want to miss the opportunity. Tell my audience, where can you find this on Facebook and YouTube? And feel free to cross post. Just don't cross post between YouTube and Facebook because they don't like each other.
Yeah, thank you. You're the only other person that ever tells people that, and they don't know anyone. Don't play with these two together. But I'm on YouTube. It's Rick Dancer TV, and then you'll find a playlist called The Truth About Timber. We've done probably 15 different stories over the last three. This is our third year on everything from Oregon stuff to, and then also it's on YouTube. But that's the YouTube channel. Then on Facebook, it's Get Real with Rick Dancer. Rick Dancer. If you go Rick Dancer on there, you will find the truth about timber stuff.
Hey, you know what, Rick?
Well,
I've got your next story for you. Okay.
Okay.
How about an honest to God forest scientist named Bob Zybeck? And
I know Bob really well.
But he's running for Lane County Commissioner. And he's got a lot of great ideas. And I tossed him one, and I think he's going to try to press it. Do you know Alaska's permanent dividend that they talk about?
No.
Every time they pull a barrel of oil out of the ground, some of the money goes to the state of Alaska. And a big chunk of that goes into what they call this permanent dividend fund. And then from that, every single year, every person who's a permanent resident gets a check. And it can amount to $1,000 a head. Family of four gets $4,000.
Yeah.
No, but do you know why this matters? If everybody in the big populous counties, the ones who think of the forest as a place to drive through on the way to the beach or the mountain or whatever, if all of them got checks every year and they said, where does the money come from? It comes from cutting trees. And then you had politicians saying, I'm against cutting trees. I don't want any trees cut down at all. Guess what would happen to those politicians? Right now, they don't have skin in the game because all they're told is, well, some money goes from the Forest Service to the state, from the state to the county, and then the county spends it on something, but you don't actually experience it. If you actually got it in the form of a permanent dividend, the Oregon or Washington permanent forest dividend, whatever you want to call it, come up with a clever name. I think Bob Zybeck can make that happen, and he's running for Lane County Commissioner. That is Rick Dancer. Find his stuff online, Facebook, YouTube, or cross-post it. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of The Lars Larson Show. Fires. A reminder, you are in control.
Our Constitution is a document in which we, the people, tell the government what it is allowed to do.
This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. You know, a lot of us worry that there is something in the water in Washington, D.C. You send a conservative back to Capitol Hill in case of elected leadership, and they get back there, and all of a sudden they start saying different things and doing different things, and you wonder, What exactly infected them? Well, the same concern is there for presidential appointees to some of the major industries. And two of the names that come to mind in this case are Kash Patel and Dan Bongino. Now, Tom Fitton joins me now from Judicial Watch, who keeps a close eye on this kind of thing. Tom, by the way, is most recently out with a new book called Rights and Freedoms in Peril, an investigative report on the left's attack on America. Tom, welcome back. And you say that there are signs that Kash Patel and Dan Bongino may have been taken hostage by the deep state?
Yeah, there's this consensus approach, Lars, to, you know, dealing with these issues, especially FBI accountability, that, you know, Dan and Kash seem to be following, which is, you know, maybe move some people out, fire a few people, change some priorities, but leave the infrastructure of abuse in place potentially for someone else to come in and do what they did to Trump all over again, either to Trump again or to someone else who's a political opponent of any the leftist president in charge at the time. And that's my concern. There's no urgency, for instance, and accountability for the efforts to jail Trump. You know, the agency is going to be the same size by all accounts that it was when they began. Yep. It will be the same size at the end of 4 years. And it's not just Dan and Kash. It's Congress who's kind of out to lunch on this. You know, we can talk about the immigration invasion and MS-13 and such, but in the end, it was the FBI and the Justice Department and White House officials and their allies in the various states at the most senior levels of government that were trying to destroy the Republic.
I agree with you. Wasn't there a report out this week that indicated that right after J6 that the Bureau was devoting more than half of its entire resources to January 6th investigation, which was largely political? It wasn't about necessarily a threat to the nation. It was just a bunch of folks who went in and committed, in most cases, some fairly minor offenses that ordinarily would have got you a ticket and maybe to stand in front of a judge at some point, but not being locked up for years. But the Bureau was allocating 50-60% of its resources there, which meant that they weren't looking at anything else like real threats to the country. How do they get that fixed, and why would Patel and Bongino get captured so quickly and say, okay, here's the company line, we're going to keep the deep state of the FBI in place?
Well, the challenge is, Lars, they don't think they've been captured. They think they're actually doing what they said they're going to do, and, you know, they're doing what they can within the system or within the lines that have been drawn for them by others. I would submit, you know, they say that literally, but, you know, that's what I'm seeing. And it's no surprise. I think the number's even higher when you consider that they kind of broadened their reach to anyone who questioned the election. It wasn't just January 6ers. You know, the FBI, they sent people to my home to give me a subpoena because I submit I was on the wrong end of fights in the lawfare against Trump, calling them out. Judicial Watch was suing them. And, you know, that's what the FBI is about, as far as I'm concerned, a political hatchetman for the men and for the presidency.
Yep.
And, you know, Trump isn't doing any of that. That's clear. But, you know, he's an ethical guy. And you have got, you know, a party and a political philosophy that has no philosophical objection to using these deep state agencies to target and jail their political opponents.
Well, and in fact, Tom, I've always been struck by the fact that the FBI seemed to protect, in my words, the Biden crime family, whether they were in office or out of office. So I think it'd be bad enough if you had an agency like FBI that was true to whoever happened to be in power at the time. So you'd see them sway from doing dirty deeds for the Democrats to doing dirty deeds for the Republicans, except they don't. And they seem to stay loyal to the Democrat cause, even when Republicans are in charge in the Oval Office and on Capitol Hill. And that's hard to understand unless it's about, what, the collective personal ideology of FBI agents or FBI administrators? What would cause them to stay loyal to the Democrats, whether the Democrats are in power or out of power? Do you have any insight?
That's a good question. And you know, my off-the-cuff answer is they're betting with who they think the winners are. And they see people like Trump or conservative reformers or
very conservative Republicans as temporary tenants of the offices they hold. And the winners are the Bidens, the Obamas, the Clintons, the permanent bureaucracy of each state. So they're always going to put their chits in with the folks who are going to be around the longest, because that's who butters their bread in the end, both budgetarily and in terms of allocating power.
Okay, so how should Cash Patel and Dan Bongino be busting this up or engineering something within the agency so that outcome is the least likely to happen? I don't know that you could prevent it altogether, but how do you make it least likely to happen?
Yeah, that's a good point. It's radical transparency, serious criminal investigations, although I would argue the FBI shouldn't even be doing it because they're conflicted. But, in the least, they should be comprehensively looking at these issues. But in the end, they have to treat the FBI like USAID and the Department of Education. It should be a husk of its former self. At the end of the 4 years of the Trump term, and the president needs to sign on to this too, the only folks at the FBI should be Cash Patel and a few folks to turn the lights on and off every day.
You know, Tom, a number of years ago, I covered a bunch of scandals within a drugs and vice division at police bureau. And you found out there were people in there who'd been there for a decade. And they discovered that turnover was important because they said, you leave these guys in here too long and they start to get up to all kinds of nonsense. But if you roll over the agency and say, you've worked in drugs and vice, now you're going somewhere else. We're bringing in new people. When the new people came in, they'd say, what the heck are you guys doing here if you've been doing this? And it had that effect. Could that same approach be taken with an agency like FBI? So when people say, we're going to do political dirty tricks because they leave us in the same places within the agency, say, no, you're going to cycle in here for a couple of years, then you're going to somewhere else, and somebody new is going to come in. And then if you get up to any nonsense, the newcomers, if they're good people, will raise an alarm and say, hey, do you realize what the agency's been doing?
But, that's not the way government works. I mean, the culture is that you have people there with longevity, and the culture may not require improper activity all the time, but it certainly envisions and allows for it at times and condones it or makes excuses for it. And we see that time after time with the FBI. I think of the old The Untouchables.
Yep.
At the end of the movie, Kevin Costner, the FBI guy, recognizes the jury's been bought, right, in the trial of Al Capone. And he goes up to the judge. And what did the judge do? And this is to your point. The judge had been bought, too, so he was in a corner. The judge says, okay, bring in the jury from the next room. And he replaced the entire jury.
Wow, that would be one approach to it. That's Tom Fitton. His latest book is called Rights and Freedoms in Peril. Tom heads up Judicial Watch. And Tom, I very much appreciate you taking the time today to give us some perspective on that.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And, of course, I got a few emails from people saying, well, Musk can't be president of the United States. No, he can't. But I didn't want to derail the caller in his naysaying. I guess I could really throw a loop to Representative Jim Walsh, who's also chair of the Washington State Republican Party, by asking about the Musk-Trump fight. But, obviously, Jim, if you want to comment on the most written about fight in America, anywhere in America, probably in the last 6 months, it would be Musk and Trump. So if you want to throw in your two cents, I'd be glad to hear it before we talk about vote by mail and proof of citizenship.
Oh, sure, Lars. Good to talk to you. Have you seen those memes on the internet of Musk and Trump sitting next to each other on their cell phones laughing as the world explodes about
their fight? You know what? You're on the same page I'm on, because we made today's X poll. We always put up a poll question out of the news of the day, and I said, is it real or political theater? And I voted for theater. I think it is pure theater, and I think the two are participants in it, and I think that's okay. Obviously, it's got the media in a dither.
Yeah, and they clearly like each other. I mean, look, even friends disagree about things, and maybe they're having some fun with it. It definitely, it sort of makes ridiculous this long simmering, you know, rumor about Trump and the Epstein Island scandals. You know, it makes it all seem kind of like pro wrestling, Lars. And I think this may be very smart in their parts to sort of blow it up and just make the whole thing look ridiculous.
It is kind of funny because I cited for people, Jim, do you have any doubt in your mind that if anybody on this planet other than Elon Musk, but somebody on the Democrat Party side had any kind of proof that Trump was engaged in any kind of misbehavior involving Jeffrey Epstein, the underage girls, Sex Island, and the Lolita Express, that would have been made public a long, long time ago?
I really believe it would have been, Lars. They would have blown it up long before this. So I think these guys are having some fun with it. I hope they are. And, you know, maybe they disagree about some things, but I think they agree about more than they disagree.
I think you're right. Let's get to something really consequential, and that is a movement that kind of started in Oregon, is going strong in Oregon, to end vote by mail and also to require proof of citizenship and same-day voting and an election day that really is election day. The Washington State Republican Party is joining into that?
Yes, it is. We've been working with Oregon, with some people in California, with some good people in Colorado, Nevada. There are a bunch of Western states that are all, each in their own way, trying to establish better standards of election integrity. Now, here in Washington, our rules for initiatives are a little bit different than across the river in Oregon. In Oregon, there's more flexibility. You can do more with an initiative than a single initiative. You can touch on multiple points. Here in Washington, there's the so-called single subject rule, and it's pretty strict. We can only touch on one point in the law or policy in each initiative. So the initiative we chose to start with on the issue of restoring election integrity is that proof of citizenship, the voter ID element of it. That's what IL-26-126, that's the initiative number. That's what the initiative in Washington does. It requires proof of citizenship when a person registers to vote in Washington. That's all it does. It doesn't touch on other elements. Those would be next. Those would be other initiatives. This one just focuses on the proof of citizenship piece.
So, and let me ask you something. With the single subject rule, I'm kind of inclined to say, should there be an initiative to get rid of that? Because it seems like a stupid requirement, because then the other side will always go to court and say, well, while it appears to be a single subject, we're actually going to convince a judge it actually has to do with two things. I don't know how anybody gets something down to just simply one thing. And as you've said, proof of citizenship appears to be a single subject. Could you run a companion initiative that also asked for the end of vote by mail and let citizens vote for both?
Yeah, we thought about doing that. You know, we could do a group, one that does proof of citizenship, one that ends vote by mail, one that requires same-day tabulation and reporting. But we decided just to start with the first one first. Any of these election integrity issues are kind of hot topics, and we just thought that it was better to focus on one first, get it rolling, get the signatures going, and then we'll take the next issues each in its own turn after this one.
Okay, and have you done any polling, or has the Washington GOP done any polling to indicate? Because my read on the public is the public would do this in a heartbeat.
We've done a little bit of more like focus group research. The best poll done so far is one of the TV news stations in Seattle did a poll on it, not entirely scientific, but a popular poll, and it came in at over 85% pro, very strong pro.
And that shouldn't surprise anybody, because when the national polls have been done and they say, do you want all the illegals out, which I think is an allied issue to the one about citizen voting, I think the two kind of go together, there's huge support, two-thirds support for kicking every single illegal out of the United States, whether they've committed other crimes or not. And then when it comes to, okay, would you like these people you're about to kick out to be able to vote in your elections? Well, that seems like a well, duh. No, of course we don't.
Well, the argument that the left is making against these reforms largely has to do with, well, really, you have a secret agenda. Really, you're a racist and you want to prevent minority people from voting in America. That is so That's just nuts. That is not what we're doing at all. That's no part of our thinking on this issue, Lars. What we want to make sure is everyone who votes is legal to vote, and every legal vote gets counted. It's absolutely a positive message on making sure that our elections are trustworthy and reliable.
Well, doesn't that kind of suggest to you that the opponents of it don't really have a good argument against it, so they decide, let's throw the race card and see if we can get everybody diverted over to talking about race and racists and all that, and then they won't be talking about citizenship because, frankly, immigrants to America come in every color.
Correct. That's absolutely right. It's a red herring argument. It's a silly argument. I was just talking with, I won't even say who, but a member of the mainstream media, very left wing. And this fellow couldn't even keep his hypothetical straight, Lars. It was falling apart as he was trying to say it.
By the way, I want to ask you something else. Let's go back to Musk and Trump, because Musk's big gripe, and I have the same gripe philosophically, is the big, beautiful bill too fat? Is it bloated with pork? Absolutely it is. But do you think that Trump, because I ask people to walk this through in their head, so what should Trump do? He should condemn the big, beautiful bill and then say he's not going to sign it. And that will make sure it does not pass. And then at some point, when a bill is not signed, the government will shut down. And the max shelf life on that is about 30 days. I think the last one that where he actually refused to sign the budget bill, the shutdown lasted for 30 days. The bill was signed anyway, and we went on with business as usual. I think Trump realizes that sabotaging or throwing your monkey wrench into the gears to stop the big, beautiful bill doesn't accomplish anything. But once the spending bill arrives on his desk, he can say, and I'm going to tell you how much of that bill we're going to spend. And when they drag him into court and say, but you're violating the Impoundment Reform Act of 74, he's going to say, good, take me to court. Good luck. You'll be done in a few years, and I'll be done too.
You know, the left can hate Trump all they want, Lars. He's a really good negotiator, and he understands the frame of debate on issues quickly and pretty effectively. And I think he is doing exactly what he wants to do here. You said it. And also, we need to shine a light on the real problem back in D.C. What D.C. really needs to do is get back to the business of passing actual budgets.
Jim, I'm going to have to run. That's Jim Walsh, chair of the Washington State Republican Party, also a state representative. We'll be back in a moment. You got the Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. President of the United States always knew where to put the blame.
You have blamed mistakes of the past, and you blame the Congress. Does any of the blame belong to you?
Yes, because for many years I was a Democrat.
This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. When Donald Trump first announced his tariffs, his much maligned tariffs, by the way, the so-called experts were freaking out. They're going to cause so much inflation. Well, did it? Did it raise costs? Did it kill American manufacturing as they claimed it would? Pete Sepp joins me now, who's president at the National Taxpayers Union. Pete, welcome back to the program.
Always great to be here.
Am I wrong in saying that there were a lot of critics of President Trump's tariffs who said this is going to cause huge inflation?
Sure, there were plenty of them. We're not sure, actually, what kinds of effects tariffs are going to have on raw materials that are brought here and then manufactured into things in American plants by American workers. What we're hoping for is that the president's stated trade policy of zero tariffs, zero non-trade or non-tariff barriers, and a new type of American-based manufacturing are the types of principles he's going to stick with. Otherwise, yeah, we may yet find ourselves in trouble with tariff policies.
Am I right in assuming there are some big retailers, in fact, some that were very public about what they were going to do, saying, we're not going to pass those costs along for now, but they might later on. But it all depends on how the rest of the economy responds to these signals. If you send a signal through tariffs, I guess you can do the alternative. Same thing I do if I go to the grocery store and steak is too expensive, I buy chicken. If chicken's too expensive, I buy hamburger. If hamburger's too expensive, then I buy Top Ramen. But I can make choices. That's substitute goods. If that starts happening and American companies start saying, well, we're going to buy the American alternative instead of bringing something in from China, that's not a bad thing either, is it?
Yeah, that's part of the equation. Also part of the equation are other policies that the president and Congress are working on. There are still projections out there showing that in isolation, very high tariffs, in other words, the Liberation Day tariffs, perhaps more reciprocal or retaliatory tariffs, if that happens down the line, we're going to have some serious adjustments to our economy that could produce a slowdown in growth. How do you offset that? Well, with smart tax policy, the one big beautiful bill, the pro-business portions of the bill that allow you to deduct all of your investments in plant and equipment up front instead of having to pay a tax on the depreciated value year after year, the research and development expensing, the small business deduction. All of those, unfortunately, will expire in some fashion or another by the end of this year, unless Congress acts. The signs are encouraging that both the House and the Senate, with their versions of these bills, are going to follow through, but we've got to keep that pressure up.
By the way, Pete, I'm frustrated with my business because I've been in the news business for a long time. I'm now on the opinion side of the news business, but it doesn't mean I've left my journalist credentials behind. And it frustrates me. Today I saw a story about a little toy store that was having trouble because they bring in virtually all their product from China. And I thought, well, I'd like to see a story because I'll bet there's a store out there like that that has always appreciated buying locally for other reasons. And now they're benefiting tremendously and their business is up. Now, it may not be, you know, one for one, but for every business that's having a tough time because they just lost half their workers to an ICE raid, I'll bet there's a business out there that's always prided itself on hiring only legitimate workers. And now their business is growing tremendously because they didn't get raided by ICE. And I think that's where the mainstream media, the cartel media, has been falling down on this mission.
It is possible. And of course, I think what we need to do is a better job of cataloging all of these experiences with current tariff policies. I mean, that's one of the reasons that we've just created a new website called Tariffs Report that's going to start gathering stories of small businesses, especially, and how they might be coping or not coping with current tariff policies, what their concerns might be. And my guess is that in addition to the tariff policies, there are also going to be many of them out there expressing other economic policy concerns, taxes, even the debt that the federal government is running up that might be constraining the credit that's available to the private sector and these businesses to expand. So we're looking forward to learning more about how the business community, especially the small business community, is thinking about all these things.
By the way, Pete, one of the concerns I've got is they say, well, Trump's tariffs created about 1,000 jobs in steel, but they're telling us it's 75,000 jobs that have been wiped out in companies that use the steel and aluminum. Is it really possible that there were companies that used steel and aluminum, and when the price went up, they just simply stopped manufacturing altogether?
Well, they either could do that. They could raise their prices. They could slow their business activity down to the point where they didn't need as many workers. And in some cases, the competition from imported steel or products that are kind of transited through other countries might have damaged those U.S. businesses to the point where they said, well, we're going to have to shift to something else.
Pete, I appreciate it. Remind my audience one more time, where can they find the tariff report?
It's tariff-report.com, tariff-report.com. PeteSep.com.
That is Pete Sepp, the president of the National Taxpayers Union. Pete, it's always great to have you on.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The Lars... Welcome to First Amendment Friday on the Lars Larson Show.
Friday is for everybody.
Today, Lars puts you in the driver's seat. You talk about what you want to talk about.
Government is the problem.
No topic is off limits.
They look like the Canadians are here.
Call 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS.
Thank goodness it's Friday. Happy Friday. Friday.
This is
First Amendment Friday with Lars Larson.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I want you to imagine something. Imagine the message that is sent to citizens of the Pacific Northwest when a state agency that has a rather critical role in deciding whether or not a convicted killer is let loose from prison early. Imagine when that agency says, we understand that the community has been deeply affected by what has happened and that a lot of people want to have input prior to us letting this killer go early. Turns around and says, by the way, nobody from the community is allowed to actually attend the hearing, not to listen and certainly not to talk. Well, Rob Francis, director of operations at our affiliate station, KONA, in the Tri-Cities, News Radio 610, joins me now. He's the guy who brought this whole story to my attention and, in fact, helped me in getting a hold of the widow of Bob Mars, the high school teacher killed more than 20 years ago, whose killers were sent to prison for sentences of roughly three decades and now are being considered for early release. Rob, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me back, Lars. Appreciate it.
Now, if I got any of that wrong, feel free to correct me, but I sent a note to this bizarrely named agency called the Indeterminate Sentence Review Board. I almost think they made up the name because nobody has. If they'd called it the Parole Board or the Probation Board, people would have said, well, I have a rough idea of what that is. But these are the folks who literally said the board understands this case, the case of Bob Mars and his killer, has affected the community and many community members may like to provide input right before they say, but nobody from the community except the victim, Bob Mars, survivors, his widow, or witnesses to the case is allowed to provide any of that input or even attend the meeting. Now, how do they explain this bizarre messaging to tell the public, we want to hear what you've got to say, but you're not allowed to come?
You know, if I had an answer to that, Lars, I could probably find answers to a lot of the other things that don't make sense in Washington State that come down from either the legislature or the executive branch. But I was stunned when I saw the press release. Although, to be honest with you, I don't ever recall seeing a press release before addressing a specific community concerns meeting, which tells me, and I want to thank you for helping spread the word on this, that tells me that everything that we have done to bring attention to this has had an impact on them, and they felt they needed to address this because of the feedback and the response regarding this particular case and this particular meeting.
I mean, because just so people understand, and Rob, would you mind telling my audience what happened to Bob Mars a bit more than 20 years ago? Why was he killed? Who killed him? Who was convicted of killing him? And what were they told was their sentence?
It was one of the most senseless acts of violence that I can remember. Bob Mars was a middle school teacher. He was a high school football coach and a wrestling coach. He taught at Coyote Benton Middle School. And after a football game, they went back, little celebration, and then back in that day, they would take the tapes back to the school. Well, he took them back to Coyote Benton Middle School. And at that time, he was approached by two teenagers. One was Robert Suarez. The other was Jordan Castillo. They asked if they could use a phone to call a ride. That was obviously not their true intention. As they were getting ready to leave and they approached Bob, Jordan Castillo plunged a knife into Bob Mars, that it went through his aorta and bruised his spine. He did not live much longer, but lived long enough to be able to get into the middle school building proper so that the doors could close behind him and at least he could have some aspect of trying to get away.
Yep.
Everything that we found out on the trial that followed and the evidence that was gathered told us that Castillo and Suarez did this as part of a gang initiation, that Bob Mars was just the wrong guy at the wrong place at the wrong time, and that the goal was to earn their way into this gang. That's it. That's how senseless this was.
And I guess what I find senseless is then you put these people, there should be truth in sentencing. They were sentenced to, it was 27 years and 30 years, is that right?
Right about there, yeah. 26 and some change for Suarez and 29 and change for Castillo. Castillo, not only did they both get convicted of first degree murder, but Castillo also got hit with a charge of robbery as well because they ransacked Bob's truck after they killed him.
Okay, so they get these sentences, and as far as I'm concerned, they should serve the entire sentence. But now they're talking about letting Suarez out almost a decade early?
Yeah, Suarez could get out. Next month is his hearing. The community concerns meeting is a week from Monday. He could potentially be let out of jail if they decide that he has served his time in 20 years. And Castillo, he could get out in February. That's when his hearing is scheduled. These are the things that frustrate Washingtonians across the board, I think, Lars. We hear these statements from legislators, and to be honest with you, I firmly plant the blame for things like this at the feet of Tara Simmons, Roger Goodman, Monka Dhingra, all of these lawmakers who put the rights of criminals or want to restore rights to criminals and take them away from victims and reduce public safety and make people in communities feel less safe because now they don't know whether the justice system is going to work for them or not because lawmakers are passing laws to make it easier for criminals to get out of jail and harder for victims to be able to move on and deal with the traumas that have been inflicted upon them.
I'm talking to Rob Francis from our affiliate station, KONA in the Tri-Cities. Last question. Does this board, and this just occurred to me, the board says this is the rule. We're not allowed to let the public in either to hear what is testified to or to offer anything. But at the same time, we're saying it's a community concerns hearing. Are they doing that because the law says they have to? Or are they doing that because the indeterminate sentence review board made up a rule? Do you know?
You know, I don't know the answer to that question, but most of the things that Washington state government does and has done for the better part of the last half a dozen years or so has been cowardly. This is yet just another one. I don't think they want to be pressured into keeping Suarez in jail. If you were to ask me, Lars, I think they've already got their mind made up. I think they already know they're going
to
release
it. It sounds
him.
Like it to me, and I just wonder, because, Rob, there are all these government institutions say, we have to do this because of the rules. And you say, well, who wrote the rules? And they say, we did. Well, if you wrote the rules, and then you say, we can't do this because of the rules that we wrote, you could fix that if you actually wanted to hear from the community. Is it the case that you don't want to hear from the community? And, Rob, I wrote to the board this morning, to their representative, and I said, look, I'd like to hear what the board has to say. So far, I have yet to hear back from them. That hearing is coming up on the 23rd of June. If you want information about it, I'll be glad to provide it to you. And Rob, thank you very much for bringing this one to our attention.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
And tell Nick Lars sent you.
Gun- Gun Control Explained.
Want to stop drunk drivers from killing sober drivers? Ban sober drivers. That's how gun control works.
This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Monday. Always glad to get to your calls. President Trump just appointed four Orthodox rabbis to his Religious Liberty Commission. What impact are they going to have on protecting religious freedom for all in America? I thought we'd talk to one of them, who's Rabbi Yaakov Menken, Managing Director at the Coalition for Jewish Values, the largest rabbinic public policy organization in America. Rabbi Yaakov, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, are advisory boards like this worthwhile? Can they make some meaningful changes?
One really doesn't know until they've told us that they're going to tell us what exactly they want from us. But obviously, it gives us a certain greater ability to make statements in the public sphere that speak to this issue, and hopefully, we can make a difference.
I mean, as though you need more gravitas than you've got already, right?
Well, that's true, but, you know.
Go ahead, Rabbi.
We can be the largest rabbinic public policy organization in America. That doesn't stop people on the left from claiming we don't really represent anybody.
And how in the world do they do that? Because, I mean, do they just suggest that you don't really represent a large constituency of American Jews?
That's basically where it starts from. I mean, obviously, if you're a little bit more rational, that doesn't work anymore because, you know, if 6 years ago people were saying, who do you represent in the Orthodox world, today it's, well, who don't they represent in the Orthodox world? obviously that's changing, but it took a while for people to accept that, and just the fact that now this appointment is kind of an indicator that the president and his administration, at least, take us very seriously.
Well, and in fact, do you think that Trump is getting some things accomplished by sort of taking a shot across the bow of a lot of major institutions, private colleges to begin with, that have not actually been exhibiting any kind of pluralistic view toward religion?
Well, that's really what this Religious Liberty Commission is about. Because there's no question that as much as America was founded on this desire for religious liberty, various governments within the United States, including the federal government from time to time, has been unfriendly to religious liberty, wanting preference for some groups over others, the Blaine Amendments to go after Catholic private education. Other efforts that are even current ones against Jewish organizations and schools in New York, we're seeing a lot going on.
Yeah, well, and then, of course, the activities of the FBI and the DOJ during the 4 years of Joe Biden, where they were openly antagonistic toward, conservative Christians in America. And we're suggesting that if you were a conservative Christian, if you went to talk to your local school board and tried to keep evil ideas out of your public schools, that you were, number one on the threat board when it came to domestic terrorist organizations and that kind of nonsense.
It's really been very interesting to watch the reversal, the inversion of who's promoting violence and who's trying to stop the violence. You know, you're not promoting violence when you go to a school board meeting and say, why are you teaching my child stuff that I don't agree with?
Well, and in fact,
my kid in public school, you should be limiting yourself to the things that every American agrees with. That's kind of a simple baseline expectation in the public education system.
It should be, because you should be able to say to the public education system, teach them reading, writing, and arithmetic, a bit of geography, maybe a bit of neutral history about the world and about the United States, and leave the rest of it to the parents and to whatever extent the parents want, to the community, but leave the rest of it. But what we saw was, public schools becoming these open, indoctrination camps for kids where the basics were forgotten, which is why we have dropping reading scores and math scores, and yet they were pushing every other political and sexual agenda, which I would think they would understand innately was going to be rejected by a majority of parents.
They, but it was anything but innate, as you saw. I mean, they were so convinced of their new, it's a really a religion. You know, the LGBTQ, the leftism, it's their own religion, but instead of calling it a religion, they call it an identity characteristic. So therefore, if you believe, for example, marriage is between a man and a woman, you yep. are hateful. This whole idea that we're transphobic because you don't believe it's a good idea for doctors to be telling parents, oh, you need to give this kid hormones to block puberty or else they're going to be, you know, suicidal or what have you, with no evidence, no real scientific evidence to back them up. And you see the Europeans now turning with the opposite direction on this issue, precisely because the medicine has not backed them up. The results have not proven. And yet, in America, it is still being promoted and calling parents hateful if they insist otherwise.
Well, it's interesting that I took a little break with my granddaughter and my wife last week, and we went on a little road trip. But what I was doing, I was still watch what's going on in the news, and I saw that the new Pope had come out with a statement about family and children and said the best place for children is a household with a mother and a father who are married. And I thought, oh, okay, I can get on board that. I may not be as crazy about the rest of the Catholic theology, but I can get on board that. I think that's great, and it sounds like a gigantic change. In fact, it surprised me when I didn't see more reaction to that, because that, of course, does not exactly line up with the left's point of view. Their point of view is, hey, any situation where the kid is, that's okay.
You know, and I think the reason why you saw very little reaction is because it's the new Pope. He's in a honeymoon period, as it were. So they can't leap on to criticize what he's saying. If he said the same thing in 3 years, maybe they'd have a different reaction, which is kind of sad when you think about it. Everything that he was saying, it's not just basic Catholic theology. It's just, you know, it's proven by study after study that the best place for a child to grow up is a married two-parent home.
Yeah, and I think good for him for coming out and saying that, and we'll see how well, you know, American Catholics take to it, because they've been led to believe that it's a cafeteria. You can take, you know, one from here and one from there and skip the rest of the line and you're okay. I don't buy that. And, you know, but then again, that gets us into theology, which usually gets me into trouble. Rabbi, congratulations on being chosen along. And do you have any problem with the other three choices? Gottlieb and...
Interesting that all four of us are Orthodox rabbis. I think President Trump recognizes that it's the Orthodox Jewish community uniquely that is not only pushing for religious liberty for all, but that's because they are facing the biggest challenges. If you look at the composition of this advisory board, it's four Catholic priests and four Jewish rabbis, two Protestants and one Greek Orthodox. Because he's prioritizing the areas where we've faced bigotry, even here in America, and discrimination. So I think he really made some very good choices here.
Sounds like intellectual diversity, and I have no problem with intellectual diversity. I just don't like the skin color and sex kind. Rabbi, thank you very much.
Have a great day. Thank you.
Thanks, Rabbi Yaakov.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show.
I know y'all think it takes balls to be singing what I'm singing, but I'm just saying what you're thinking.
This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. I want to ask you this, and it's not a rhetorical question. Are activists in the Pacific Northwest trying to use the courts to put farmers out of business? Dylan Honkoop joins me now. He's with a group called Save Family Farming, although he used to be in radio, and I want you to forgive him for that. A lot of us in radio actually do work out well at some point. Dylan, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me, Lars. And yes, the answer is yes, the activists have taken control and are wagging the dog here.
Now, what's going on with the U.S. EPA, that's a federal agency, and what they're doing with their Seattle office? Because Yakima farmers have been trying, you know, to do what they have to do to address the rules and go by the rules. And if I'm wrong about that, feel free to correct me.
Well, they've been accused of causing water pollution in the Yakima Valley. It's been a big deal there for a long time. Now, there are lots of different scientific reasons behind that going back 50-plus years. But for whatever reason, the focus has been on the dairy farms there, which have really only gotten big and well-developed in the last 20 to 30 years. Something doesn't really add up there already. And what we have seen here, and we told you about this a few months ago when I talked with you, Lars, the embedded long-time activists, bureaucrats within the EPA and their Region 10 office in Seattle have been running roughshod over the rules to do whatever they can via the courts and via their own powers to basically strangle these farms that they have said they don't like out of business. And that's what's so scary about this, to bring the power of the federal government against private citizens this way. People have asked, well, what about the new administration? Are they going to fix this? Well, they've got a long list of things to work on, obviously. You talk about that all the time. This is something that we want representative, former representative, now administrator of the EPA, Lee Zeldin, and Emma Pocon, who's the administrator of Region 10 in Seattle here in Washington State, to take this seriously. There's a big problem here, and we're digging up more public records that are just blowing the lid off of what's really been going on behind the scenes.
Well, here's the thing I don't understand, because I've been hearing about nitrate problems in groundwater around farming operations for a long, long time. As you point out, it's not just in the recent times. But, you know, when the new president takes over and appoints a secretary of the EPA, or an administrator of the EPA, I should say, he's not a secretary, but you can't wipe out all of that entrenched bureaucracy at once. I mean, I guess unless you just walked in and fired everybody, and then you'd have to repopulate the agency to some extent. What is it that they were going to do in working with the farmers, and what they're now refusing to do?
Well, they had been involved in this community-based process that's been going on since the last time they sued these farmers, which was over 10 years ago, to work on the issue, come up with practical solutions. Okay, let's do something about this. What's interesting is suddenly in the last few years, they backed out of that process. They've been essentially MIA and not substantively contributing or participating in this community process. So if you're really worried about pollution so much that you're going to sue these farms yet again, which they did last summer, the same farms that they had sued 10 years before saying they hadn't done enough, don't you think they'd still want to be involved in that process? Yet they backed out of it. And what's been so interesting is that we've dug up the public records. At the same time they were backing out of the community process to actually do something about this, they were having secret meetings with anti-farm activist groups who are trying to push these farms out of business. We've documented a whole list at SaveFamilyFarming.org, this whole list of private emails going back and forth about this series of meetings that they've been having in the last year or two, working basically as activists from their positions within the EPA. We told the Trump administration about this during Trump 1.0. They weren't able to deal with it. We've got to deal with it now before it's too late.
Okay, and I want people to appreciate this, because even if most people say, well, I'm not a farmer and I don't know any farmers, you go to the store and you buy milk. Milk comes out of those dairies. You go to the store and you buy meat and hamburger and steak and everything else. You buy chicken, you buy all these things. They come from farms. Is EPA trying to suggest that nothing these farmers can do is going to fix the problem, so the farmers should just go away?
It's a good question. And, you know, there are a lot of, shall we say, vegan types in some of these groups that they've been very cozy with, as we've seen in their private emails over the last couple of years in particular. So what is their real MO? Maybe they want us to all drink oat milk, which I don't think deserves the name milk at all. I think, you know, this almond milk, oat milk should be called, you know, nut juice, oat juice. It's not the same thing.
No, actually, nut juice, I think, fits both the product and its consumers in many cases. But, Dylan, this is the thing I want people to think about. And you'd say, well, of course a regulatory agency would talk to activists. Why? if there are rules to be enforced, then enforce the rules. I mean, to me, this would be like if you were trying to build a new hotel and the regulatory agency, the city's building inspectors, went to all the other hoteliers and said, hey, should we help Dylan finish his hotel? And they said, no, don't help him out. I mean, in other words, you're talking to people in the activist groups, the vegan activist groups, who want the farms to go away. They want animal husbandry and the rest of that to cease. So why would a regulatory agency that's there to enforce the rules be asking questions from folks who don't want the farms to exist at all?
It's that mob kind of activity that you're describing, Lars, that's behind the scenes coordination. And I would ask if there's even what would rise to the level of what people might call collusion that's been going on, as we see these private meetings called, you know, coordination meetings between activist groups, again, with a stated purpose of ending animal agriculture, and our federal government agents via the EPA in Region 10. It's got to stop. And, you know, again, they're suing these farms all over again. They sued them 10 years ago. Then they said they didn't do enough. They're suing them again. Three of the four farms that they started going after have gone out of business. Only one is left. Maybe they're getting what they're wanting by playing this long game of suing people out of business. A lot of people scoffed when we first accused them of that. But that's what's playing out.
Okay,
here.
And so when the average consumer walks into a store and is stunned by the cost of a gallon of milk, you got to think this is part of what's going on there. The second thing is, you mentioned what the farms have done. How much have they done over the last 10 years to try to, you know, comply with what EPA says it wants?
They have spent millions of dollars, and they are arguably the most environmentally advanced dairy farms anywhere in the country, possibly the world. Yet it's not good enough based on ticky-tack accusations from the EPA, who want to play a legal game. Is this about pollution? More and more, it's looking like it has nothing to do with pollution. That's just the excuse to strangle these farms.
And by the way, Dylan, is an awful lot of this about cow manure and how that puts nitrates back in the water? Is that basically what we're talking about?
That's their accusation. But
okay, but hold on, Dylan. Think about this. What does the average vegan want you to do? Does he want you to go out and grow potatoes and produce using chemical fertilizers or use the natural stuff instead? So the very people who are telling the farmers, we're mad at you because of what cow manure is doing to the water, are the very people who would tell you in the next breath that they want you to go out and grow your own food, perhaps at great expense, and they want you to use natural manure to fertilize the crop. And they can't exactly have it both ways. Although, when it comes to liberals, if they didn't have double standards, they'd have no standards at all. Dylan, thanks very much. That's Dylan Honkoop with a group called Save Family Farming. Check out their website. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Your emails are welcome. talk@larslarson.com. And check out my Instagram feed, where you'll find I've got a face for radio. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and The Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of The Lars Larson Show.
Hey, it's...
He may talk about serious issues, but even Lars has a sense of humor.
I have a joke for you. The government in this town is excellent and uses your tax dollars efficiently.
This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I want to talk to Taylor Barkley for a moment, though. Director of Public Policy at the Abundance Institute. I want to talk about AI. Hey, Taylor, welcome back.
Great to be back on the show, Lars.
So tell me this. AI, I'm finding to be a little bit more frightening than ever before, but we can get into that in just a moment. The Congress wants to, well, you know, look, I'm ready to be wowed by technology, but sometimes technology gives you the willies, and I think AI is doing that for me right now. Ordinarily, I'm a big fan of technology, but Congress wants to tell the states, we're going to do all the AI regulation. You folks leave it to us. Is that about protecting innovation or protecting big tech?
I think it's about protecting innovation. And what Congress is doing here, and this is about a 10-page provision in this one big beautiful bill, that would tie federal funds. So here's the deal. You know, if a state accepts federal funds to deploy and develop AI in the state, it's about a $500 million pot of money for the whole country. If a state accepts some of these monies, they have to abide by certain conditions to not basically single out AI for regulation. What they can do instead is to, you know, if they want specific AI regulation, they have to be regulations that spur deployment and adoption of AI, or have just laws that are generally applicable. So you can write a law that says, you know, no computer software can discriminate protected classes, for instance. But if you said AI can't do that, that would be a problem. And you know what? That's actually a better way to write the law, because someone could maybe weasel out of something and say, well, I didn't use AI to do it. I instead used, you know, this different computer program to get away with it.
Well, and if, at some point, are we going to run into a point where I've had people say, well, I used AI the other day to do X, Y, or Z. And then other people say, oh, I never used that. And then you look at their phone and you realize, without knowing it, a lot of their searches are being aided by AI. And apparently they don't even realize it. Are we going to reach that point where folks are going to use AI and not even know they're using it?
I think so. Yeah, you know, it's funny. I talk with folks all the time, all over the country, and I get like stunned faces when I say, you know, artificial intelligence has been around for 70 years. The term was first coined in the 50s. And, you know, once something, basically a computer program that's called AI at one point, it starts just getting normalized. We just call it advanced computing or computer. You know, so, you know, driving directions on Google Maps or Waze, that's a form of artificial intelligence. Some email spam filters that, you know, we all just, I take for granted, certainly. That's a different form of AI. So I think you're exactly right, Lars. It's permeating and will just become more ubiquitous.
I mean, is the key component just that it's a program that learns over time?
That's one aspect of it. Being autonomous is another key factor. The advanced software it's using, and AI takes all different forms. It's not just one thing, you know, but I think these chatbots from like ChatGPT or Google Gemini, for instance, that's what people think of right off the bat. But there are very specific kinds of AI software that's in development, from image generation or even audio generation. And that's generative AI, its own kind of thing. But, you know, at Congress, what they're doing here is want to ensure that, you know, over a thousand bills in the states don't drown out this technology, which has immense potential to improve our lives over the next, you know, decade and more.
Okay, so Taylor, let me throw a tough one at you, because as I said, ordinarily, I'm, you know, my producers, my wife would, my granddaughter would tell you, I love technology when it actually does something useful. If it's just technology for technology's sake, I'm not as much a fan of that. But when I read these reports about Anthropic and Claude 4, lashing back at some of the engineers that are creating the AI and appearing to almost exhibit not human characteristics, but threatening to get even with the folks that are writing the program, saying, don't eliminate the data from my, from my memory bank. This is starting to sound like science fiction horror movies.
That's right. It certainly does. I mean, one thing to keep in mind about that report from Anthropic in particular is, you know, that was from they really pushed it to the limit. So it's like, you know, maybe not driving a car because, you know, it exploded in a very like particular kind of test for safety reasons. So, and you know, Anthropic too, they're motivated by this vision to, you know, keep humanity safe from AI threats. So I think they want to share stories like that to kind of wake people up. So it's a bit of a shock factor there. You know, certainly we should be, you know, mindful of these types of things. But, you know, ultimately these are computer programs. Yes, they get more advanced. They do things that surprise us all the time. But, you know, that particular instance was in a very, like, controlled, kind of, like, stress test environment. And I don't think it's a common factor by any means. It's extremely, extremely rare, and that was kind of meant to do for show.
Well, I mean, Taylor, one of them where apparently the engineer working on the artificial intelligence was told, don't make those changes to the program. In other words, don't change me, or I'll reveal your extramarital affair to somebody. And I thought, okay, so now we've got machines that are lying, they're cheating, they're telling us lies, and they're threatening us. That doesn't sound like a good start. Sounds more like Skynet.
Well, you know, one thing about Skynet, that's, you know, it's a fictional scenario, and, you know, it's best not to base public policy off of fiction, I always say. You know, it's best to stay grounded in what these AI tools are doing every day. You know, I'm using them to help my kids learn about, maybe the other day they captured a snake. What kind of breed was it? And helped, you know, get them up to speed. How do they feed their pets? And I think the more folks kind of get used to those sorts of ways of using AI, that's just going to improve society overall.
That is Taylor Barkley, who's Director of Public Policy at the Abundance Institute. Taylor, it's a pleasure.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The Lars 855. Welcome to First Amendment Friday on the Lars Larson Show.
Friday is for everybody.
Today, Lars puts you in the driver's seat. You talk about what you want to talk about.
Government is the problem.
No topic is off limits.
They look like the Canadians are here.
Call 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS.
Thank goodness it's Friday. Happy Friday.
This is
First Amendment Friday with Lars Larson.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. If you ask most conservative parents, are you in charge of and do you make all the significant decisions for your children? You'd say, of course. And then if you ask liberal parents, I think some of them would say the same kind of thing, but liberal politicians. Consider that Terry McAuliffe, a prominent Democrat who ran for governor of Virginia, once said, parents have no business telling us how we educate their kids. And then, of course, you have state lawmakers, like the state lawmakers in Washington State, even when the voters vote by a majority to say parents want to have the right to make decisions and know about the affairs of their kids. The state lawmakers say, yeah, we don't care about that, and they promptly reverse that. Parents. to direct the upbringing and education of children under their control. Now, that's pretty clear. And I suppose the current U.S. Supreme Court could say, no, they got it wrong 100 years ago and reverse it. But it doesn't seem likely. So doesn't it seem likely that this law, 1296, is going to go straight to, well, through the federal courts and then to the Supreme Court. And if they take it up, they're going to make the same decision that the court did 100 years ago.
Well, I've got to tell you, it's not just this one Supreme Court case. There's over a century with more than a dozen Supreme Court cases essentially siding with parents. So if there were to be a lawsuit, I think precedent is definitely on the side of parents. Now, as for what we can do, listen, we've got to, everyone's busy. We don't necessarily watch every nanosecond of what's going on during legislative session. However, we've got to pay a whole lot more attention to whom we are supporting in our elections. And basically with education policy, let's be very clear. Don't let people give you smoke and mirrors and complicate it. When it comes to education policy, either one of two things are true. Either you believe children are in fact creatures of the state and you think people in places like Olympia know better than you, or you believe that parents know and love their children best and they should be the ones in charge. It's really, those are the only two, you know, you have to pick one or the other. And I think most people, based on the overwhelming historic number of signatures that Washingtonians gave to the Parents' Bill of Rights last year, they side with parents. So elections are coming up. Support people who support parents in Olympia. Support people who support parents in your local school board elections, your city elections, all the way down to, from dog catcher all the way on up to governor.
So why is it we haven't seen more outrage from parents when Olympia, the state government, simply says, no, we don't have to pay attention to you. We control your kids.
Well, I think most people are working jobs, taking care of themselves and their families. And so what, you know, all these outrages that have been happening in Olympia are now trickling down. People thought they took care of it last summer when they signed the petition. So now this news is getting out. And I think it's important that we get it out to regular folks who are not constantly down there, you know, in Olympia lobbying. I think as more people know, the more they're going to be paying attention. And you know what? Take 5 minutes out of your week to call the governor's office, to call your elected official, or send an email. Tell friends, families, you know, your family members and neighbors, so that the next time these folks say, claim to be looking out for you, we can get the truth out there that no, you're not. Because if you're not for parents, people are not looking out for you. They're looking out for the status quo.
You know what it reminds me of, Vicki, is a long time ago, Elian Gonzalez, that little boy from Cuba, and there was a debate about whether or not we should return him to Cuba. And a lot of us spent time reading things like the Cuban Constitution that says, in Cuba, your child is only your child as long as your interests don't conflict with those of the state. If they do, then the state takes control of your child. It seems to me that a lot of Democrats in Olympia have been channeling some communism from Cuba in what they believe about parents' rights and the rights of children. Vicki, thanks very much. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of The Lars Larson Show. Vegan actually is?
They say cows are bad for the environment because all they do is eat plants and fart, just like vegans.
This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I want to alert you to a scam that is being run on you by state lawmakers, maybe not the one currently present, Representative Christine Drazen, but by others, and also being run on you by the cartel media. because the old school media, the TV, the newspapers and all, are telling you why Portland is going to get a $2 billion ballpark and maybe even a Major League Baseball team, and it isn't going to use a dime of taxpayer money. And I think of that, Representative Drazen, I always like to disclose where I'm coming from. I think of that as just a bald-faced lie, because it is being funded by the taxpayers. So I'm not going to tell you what to say, but would you mind telling my audience, is this a taxpayer-subsidized baseball stadium?
Yeah, let me give you the skinny from my perspective, and I'm looking forward to this conversation. The taxpayers aren't on the hook for any of this. Just to be clear, this is $800 million of a possible loan. No taxpayer dollars put into this. And the people that come specifically to play, to actually work at the ballpark, the players, the people that work there, their taxes are potentially going to pay back that loan over this series of a number of years. But I want to be clear about something. This is last money in. This is not a giveaway. This is a loan. And the state isn't putting any direct taxpayer dollars into this project at all. We're talking $2 billion. They have to have Major League Baseball declare they want to bring a team here, and then they have to get every penny of investor dollars in the door first. Last money in is the option of having a loan from the state that is repaid by the people that are working in the ballpark. And so this is not...
No, you're leaving a word out. It's paid back by the taxes on the person in the ball, working in the ballpark, right?
They consider it a tax increment financing proposal. So yes, for a period of years, the taxes from the people that came because the stadium was built are directed to repay the loan. And when that's complete, from that point forward, it all goes into the general fund and everywhere else.
Let me ask you something. If any other business brings a business to Oregon and says, we need to build a building for our business. Say it's Intel. We're going to build another fab, and it's going to cost $1 billion. We'd like to have the state of Oregon let us take the tax money that would otherwise go to the state treasury and use that to pay the mortgage on our building. Would you allow that deal?
Well, we do it all the time. That's what urban renewal does. I mean, urban renewal takes tax increment and applies it to some improvement that overall benefits your economy. It's the exact same structure.
And I don't like that. I don't like that one either. But would you tell Intel, when you build your next fab, you won't have to pay for half of it, or, you know, in this case, 40% of it, because we're going to let you take the tax, income taxes your workers would have paid to Salem, and they can spend the money instead paying off the loan on 40% of your new fab. That's what this deal is, isn't it? Because when you say it's no taxpayer money, if a ball player comes and plays ball in Oregon, they pay income taxes on their income. The Blazers certainly do. So when the Blazers pay income taxes to Salem, the dollars go to Salem to provide the services provided by the state. Now, when these ball players pay their taxes, the taxes go to pay off a loan to build part of the ballpark. There's a difference there, isn't there?
I want to be super clear. I think it's crummy too, right? But I also viewed this as an opportunity and a reason to sit down with the mayor and talk about public safety in the city of Portland and talk about the fact that they have got to stop defunding police, and there needs to be a commitment that this, if they're going to do anything like this, there's no fans that are going to walk to the stadium unless the city cleans up its act.
By the way,
the opportunity to do that is through this sort of a conversation.
You got to buy Keith Wilson a ballpark before he'll talk to you about public safety? That's a high price.
You know, I agree that's a high price, and I would hope that the man would have met with me anyway. But, you know, when they come to Salem and they're shilling something that they want, it's the opportunity to say, listen, you're not keeping your own house in order. Absolutely not. This is a mess. What are you doing? And his commitment to me was that he was going to support public safety. And when they reduced dollars for cops and we said, knock it off, he came back and he identified funding to be able to address that challenge. I'm not saying he wouldn't have done it either way. And I certainly hope it's not the kind of thing that he wouldn't have met with me
had it not been for this, but he was in town. He was talking about baseball, and it's the chance to say, you got to clean up your house. Your city's a disaster. You're on the hook.
And he gets the ballpark whether it cleans up the mess or not, doesn't he?
I don't think he does. I don't think Major League Baseball gives Oregon squat diddly if Portland doesn't improve its act.
Okay,
we
by the
are
way,
competing with Utah.
Couple of other issues, and I couldn't get this from your staff. God bless them. They seem to be very willing. Who owns the ballpark?
Yeah, that will be negotiated. I would fight for the state to own the ballpark. It's our loan that's closing out this deal.
I would not.
You don't want the state to own the ballpark? You want private people to own the ballpark?
Do you know why?
Let's hear it.
Well, when private people own the ballpark, they have to pay property taxes. When the state owns it,
oh,
they
I
don't.
I do love that. Yeah.
Is that
yeah.
Now, hold on. What do you suppose the property taxes are on $2
billion? Good question. I think
it's a large number. Maybe I can't do the math in my head, but I would imagine property tax on $2 billion is a lot. By the way, who owns the land under it?
That will be the land under it currently is proposed to, I believe, be owned by the Portland Diamond Project today.
By who?
The investor group.
The investor group. So they own the land under the ballpark, but the ballpark sitting on top of it is being proposed to be owned by the state and not pay any property taxes, which is another gift to the owner, which, by the way, Portland has made stupid deals like that before. Didn't they buy the Moda for about $1? And they were all celebrating. And I said, yeah, the minute it goes to city ownership, they don't pay any property taxes on Moda. And the city says, look, we bought a ballpark for $1. And you lost, I don't know how much in property taxes. And you get to fix it up when it's busted down. Any idea how many decades it's going to take to pay off the $800 million loan using the taxes on ballplayer salary?
So they're anticipating that it will be between 8 and 15 years. The statute lets them have up to 30 years.
Okay, and
but
by the way,
then in other jurisdictions, it's been about half that.
Representative Drazen, if the state owns that ballpark 30 years from now, do you know what's going to happen? The ball team's going to say, this place is a rundown wreck. Fix it up or we'll leave town.
Well, and we're facing that struggle right now with the Trailblazers. I mean, it's for sale. And I think that we should want to keep the Trailblazers in Oregon. I don't think that we want to lose our major league team. I don't want to lose them. And so I think that Portland needs to clean up its act. I think it needs to be a comfortable place for fans to go. I think that it needs to be, you know, a world class team. And we need to be a draw.
Representative Drazen, I appreciate the time. Back in a moment. You got the Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show. At least someone has a plan for illegal aliens.
Back in the White House, I will terminate every open borders policy of the Biden administration and begin the largest deportation operation in American history.
This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you on Conspiracy Theory Thursday, and always glad to welcome back the guy whose internet feed, X feed anyway, that I follow religiously, and that is Representative Dwayne Junker, who represents District 3, that's Grants Pass, and the surrounding environs. Representative Junker, welcome back.
Thank you, Lars. Thanks for having me back.
So tell me this. Do we know where things are going? And I want to ask you first about the gun bills, and then we'll get to the money and the gigantic taxes that your Democrat colleagues on the other side of the aisle are trying to push down people's throats. Why in the world do we have more gun laws, and are they actually going to address anything in the way of public safety?
No, the gun laws are not going to change anything that were just passed. Or 243 is going to the Senate for a vote tomorrow to concur it. But the reason we have problems is our mental health is the sixth worst in the country. Our crime has been up since, I think, 2019 to 2023, violent crime. And it's got nothing to do with you and I. I'm not sure if you own guns, but I do. And
I do.
You know, we're not out committing crimes. It's not us. It's the bad people. And we've taken crime and we've reduced the sentencing on crime. So they're wanting to punish law-abiding citizens, not criminals.
And that's not likely to work out well. In fact, just in the last couple of weeks, we had plenty of examples where a good guy or a good gal with a gun has actually ended a crime early and saved lives. So I guess this is just what Democrats do. They decide we're going to outlaw law-abiding citizens from having guns and kind of hope that the criminals will follow suit, and they're not going to. Let me get to the tax side of things. So now there's an amended version of the tax plan that was going to raise almost $15 billion over a decade, and now they're going to cut it all the way from 15 down to just under 12. Doesn't sound like much of a cut, and I guess I wonder, does ODOT even need the money since they manage the money they have now so badly?
Well, ODOT doesn't need the money. What they need to do is fix their problems internally. It's a management problem. It's how we're spending money. The Republicans had a plan to change things first. I mean, if you were running a business, you just don't give them more money if they're running it poorly. You fix the problems. And we haven't even talked about the problems. That has not been a discussion. It's just give them more money. And that's just how we do things in Oregon. We don't solve problems. We just spend more money. It's like anything we do, homelessness, drugs, anything, we just spend money. It's not a great plan. It's not a plan that I would run my household that way.
Well, in fact, why is it that Tina Kotek, the governor of the state, is unwilling to actually hold ODOT to account? She's the head of the executive branch. She could act like Trump and say, if you're not doing your job, you're getting a pink slip. Goodbye.
Well, I can't speak for the governor, even though I would love to speak, tell her how I feel a lot of times.
She didn't talk to you?
We could see it. I've talked to Tina Kotek for the first time 2 weeks ago at my son's graduation at Southern Oregon University.
Wow.
That's the first time I've ever spoke to her personally. And that was cordial because I'm at my son's graduation. I don't think I'm her favorite fan. I'm very critical of, because in Oregon, we continue to grow government. We drive out businesses. But we continue to grow government, and that's just it's a backwards plan. It's not going to fix things. You know, you just had a few minutes ago as people are leaving the state. Well, that's money leaving the state. We're not bringing people here. We're driving businesses away. And so everything Tina does, or the governor, or even the Democratic Party, is to grow union people in their coffer. And that is that's not going to last forever. The government does not bring jobs. It doesn't bring industry in. It just takes and redistributes, wealth. That's all it's doing in Oregon.
Okay, so Representative Yunker, given that we've got this situation, they're going to pass more meaningless gun laws. They're going to pass massive increases in taxes. They're going to hand the money to people or agencies that are already proven to be inefficient, incompetent, or corrupt, or a combination of the above. Is it time for Republicans to just walk out, deny quorum, let the session come to an end? And when Kotek calls a special session saying, I got to have a budget, we're coming up on July 1, just say, no, we're not coming back until you agree to negotiate the terms that we'll come back under and use the only leverage you've got right now. Are Republicans ready to do that? Or are they just going to say, we've been bought off by little trinkets that the Democrats threw to a few rhino Republicans, and we're going to stick around and let the Democrats vote through whatever they want? Which one's it going to be?
Well, I've already walked out. I've been gone since Saturday. I'm out of the States. I'm on vacation, actually.
Good.
So that tells you where I'm at, because there's nothing left. There's no committees that I'm involved with that are talking anymore. It's all about bad bills, bad spending, and gifts to the people that that are voting along with the Democrats. And I'm not going to do that. I tell people, if you want to see who's getting along with who, just look at the Christmas tree bill, and you can see who's getting paid off. I'm not for sale. I am going to fight to the death for my people, and I'm going to fight for Oregonians. But that's what I have to do. And I speak up and I speak out, and I'm probably by myself a lot of times, but that's what people elect me to do, is to fight. And I have, I only have a few things to do. I could speak with my voice. I could vote, and I could walk out of that building. So even if I walk out, it's still a no vote. They need yeses. So, you know, people look at that way. That's how I look at it. I wasn't there for the gun bill. I won't be there for the gun bill. And I won't be there for the Christmas tree to give gifts out. It's not me.
Good. I'm glad to hear it. Because Representative Younger, it just strikes me as common sense. If you had, you just said your son graduated from Southern Oregon. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. Congratulations to him. I hope he didn't get a degree that ends in the word studies. But if he didn't, then he probably has a great future. So I guess what I wonder is, if one of your kids showed himself or herself to be irresponsible with money, would giving them more money fix the problem? I mean, a parent could work this thing out, but the Democrats and the Rhino Republicans can't?
No, you don't keep feeding bad behavior. I mean, that would, like, rewarding bad behavior. I have four children, all adults. The youngest is 19 years old. There's always consequences. I tell my kids, you can speed on the road, but guess what? You get a ticket. It's not the cop's fault. It's your fault. You knew what the law was. You know what it is. And if you do the right things, you won't get in trouble. But if you want to speed, you can, but there is a consequence, and you'll have to pay the fee for it. That doesn't happen in Oregon. Look at our schools. We're near the bottom, the last. We give them more money this year. We're losing population in our schools, and now we're going to hire more people to work for ODE. That's just one of many agencies that continue to grow with bad performance. That's not how you do. You're not going to reward your children for bad behavior. We shouldn't be awarding Oregon agencies for bad behavior.
No, can you imagine? But look at the example they've got, the political powerhouse in the state is Multnomah County. Portland Public Schools are about to build 1,700 student schools for schools that only have 1,000 kids in them. In one case, only 400 kids. And you wonder, why are you building a school for 1,700 kids in a school that only has 400 kids in it and has a forecast of declining population in the years ahead? Representative Younger, I hope you enjoy your vacation. Actually, you're probably in the most useful place you could be, which is away from Salem, away from the big building with the bowling trophy on top. And let's hope that the Democrats get shut down at the end of this week before they pile $15 billion in new taxes on top of Oregonians, steal their kicker, and outlaw their lawful purchase of guns. That's Representative Dwayne Younger from the Grants Pass area. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Your emails are welcome. talk@LarsLarson.com. And check out my Instagram feed where you'll find I've got a face for radio. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. A message from Lars.
I'd like to apologize to anyone I've not offended yet. Please be patient. I'll get to you shortly.
Who's next? This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'll get back to your phone calls and emails. But first, I want to talk to Dr. Isaiah Henkel, who is CEO of Overqualified.com and a best-selling author. Doctor, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on, Lars.
So you believe in a standard that I believe is the same for higher education in America, that the system is busted. It doesn't lead to prosperity for many of the people, too many of the people who go into it and pay gigantic amounts of money to get a degree. What should we do to fix that situation?
It's a good question. Well, I think you have to start a little bit in the theoretical, or at least in terms of how they're prioritizing their values. For a long time, they've been prioritizing things such as a bit more virtue signaling, doing things that I think teach students to try to have the most need rather than teaching them the most in-demand skills. And so if you replace logic and reason with trying to look like you need the most help, this is not compatible with the job market. And I know that might be a little bit out there in terms of theory, but that's the core problem.
No, I like the idea, Doctor.
Thank you. Well, I was just going to say, practically what these universities need to do is they need to start teaching in-demand skills again. They got to start teaching logic, reason. They know that math isn't racist. That's the starting point.
Well, and is it possible because I don't like the government being involved in education either, but it's way too involved. But if you were to start saying to kids, why don't you go study something that leads to a job where there's a profession that has space for you? You know, don't go after degrees that don't lead to some kind of work, unless you happen to be independently wealthy. And I would guess the vast majority of students are not independently wealthy or come from wealthy families. In that case, study something that's in demand. And I think there's a way you could do it if you decide the government is still going to be involved in making student loans. Don't make stupid loans for student loans for stupid things. If I went to a bank and said, I want to open a new donut shop, and they said, where are you going to put it? I said, I'm going to put it on the corner of this intersection. They said, Lars, there are three donut shops on that corner already. The fourth one is not going to do that well. They would say, we're not making the loan to you. Can't the lending authorities, whether they're private or government, say the same thing? We've got too many people with DEI degrees and degrees that end in the word studies. You can have a degree, but you need to go after something where there's actually a job at the other end.
You bring up a fantastic point. Check the incentives, right? So first of all, these universities need to be incentivized. Like, they should only get any level of federal funding or taxpayer funding based on how many people that they graduate who get into full-time jobs, you know, above a certain salary level that's related to their degree. This has never been done. That would fix the problem almost overnight. And you're right, the students need to take this responsibility on themselves, but also for financing. What are they taking these classes for? Why do the classes exist? Those classes would not exist. Those degrees that end in studies, like you said, would not exist if the incentives were right. And right now, there is no incentive except for these loaning companies to loan out as much money as possible to put, you know, to straddle just astronomical debt on these students. And they're, of course, in cahoots with the universities, too, because the universities, you know, they can charge tuitions like, you know, Harvard, the Ivy League, they're up to $60,000, not just the Ivy League, $60,000 a year. People can't pay that money, so the universities only survive if they can get those students easily, get them federal grants, federal loans. So that's what's propping up the whole system right now. If that goes away, many of these universities will cease to exist. I mean, we're already losing a university in the U.S. every week for the last couple of years. I think it's going to accelerate no matter what, because they can skyrocket tuition up to $100,000 a year, and they probably will. It's still not going to save the core problem, which is the wrong incentives.
Dr. Henkel, would you mind telling my audience what overqualified.com is all about? And then I've got a number of other questions.
Overqualified.com, we help people who have graduated, and maybe they worked in a career for a long time. They lost their job. They can't get hired again. You know, right now we see a lot of people who are struggling to, or have really just been replaced by cheaper labor, sometimes on a foreign visa or not, and a combination of AI tools. So we help these people who have advanced degrees that did everything right. They have the experience, but there's this manufactured, quote unquote, overqualified crisis where they're being called overqualified. They're too capable when really they just want to save money and possibly hire a cheaper worker with a combination of AI tools. So we help them overcome that and get hired into great jobs so that they continue to, you know, pass on their knowledge and help people. Because I think and we think that businesses need these people that have these leadership skills at these organizations to pass on their knowledge, not just be, you know, kicked aside after the age of 40, which is happening more and more now.
Well, and are they viewed as overqualified? Because if you give them a job, but you say, but you have vast qualifications, the minute you find a better job, you're going to leave, and that's going to cost the employer.
Yeah, exactly right. And so we train them on how to find an organization or a company that is a good fit for them as well and where they're going to stay. But you're exactly right. Employers want to avoid that flight risk. And so you have a lot of people that are proving themselves out of a job. Like, they're actually trying too hard, and they're coming across as too intimidating. And the average age of the hiring manager started to go down. I think the average age is about 30 now. Typical degree would be an associate's or bachelor's degree. So if you have somebody with these indicators that they might be overqualified, you're right. The employer is much more reluctant. So how can we make it a fit for both sides? That's really the goal.
That's Dr. Isaiah Henkel. He is the CEO of overqualified.com and a best-selling author as well. Dr. Henkel, thank you very much. I appreciate your time, and we'll have you back.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The Lars